start. We start our meeting today with a discussion on the disclosure initiative. And I give the floor. Please, go ahead.
Thank you, Hans. Okay, so we are here this morning to talk about the disclosure initiative. We have got five papers for you today, and between them they address aspects of all three of the disclosure initiative projects. So in the cover paper we have included in paragraph 8 a very high-level overview of the project plan that we on the team are working to, and that is really to help you see where the discussions we're asking you to have today fit in with the bigger picture on our project direction. So in terms of today's discussion, we're going to start with one of the follow-up items from the principles of disclosure feedback, which is all about how the board's better communications projects interact. We'll then move on to talk about targeted standards level review, and we will be discussing both aspects of that project. So first, the next step on the development of guidance for the board, and then we will be talking about the work we've done so far about which standards to select for review. Finally, and possibly after everyone's had opportunity for a big coffee, we will be asking you to re-deliberate the definition of material. So with that plan in mind, we're going to start with principles of disclosure. So over to Aisha for 11A.
Thank you, and good morning. So at its March 2018 meeting, the board asked the staff to prepare a summary of the interaction and distinction between the better communication in financial reporting projects. The board made this decision in response to feedback from respondents to the discussion paper, some of who expressed concerns about perceived overlap between the various better communication projects. The staff thinks that the decisions made by the board in March 2018 about overall project direction and focus were helpful in eliminating some of the identified overlap between the projects. So Agenda Paper 11A summarizes the interaction and distinction between the projects in light of those decisions. In summary, the staff thinks that the better communication in financial reporting theme has been used to highlight the importance and common themes between the respective projects. However, we think there are two main distinctions between those four projects. The first is that the primary financial statements, disclosure initiative, and management commentary projects are all focused on content. That is, what information users need and how that information can be provided more effectively. While the IFRS taxonomy focuses on improving the way in which those sets of information can be delivered in an electronic format. The second distinction is based on which financial information each project is primarily trying to improve. The primary financial statements project focuses on the four primary financial statements. The disclosure initiative focuses on the notes to the financial statements. The management commentary project focuses on information provided outside the financial statements. And the IFRS taxonomy enables electronic tagging across all those sources of information. So in light of the information that we've presented in this paper, the staff does not think that the board needs to make any changes to the way the better communication projects are organized. However, if the board agrees with the content of this paper, we will update the better communication page of the IFRS Foundation website to reflect that content more clearly. So the question for the board is in paragraph 54, and it asks whether the board is happy with the current interaction and distinction between the better communication projects as is presented in this paper, and if not, whether there are any changes the board would like to make. So with that, I'll turn it over to the board for discussion.
Sure. I am happy with the basic distinction you've made between the projects, but I think just to be super, super picky, because I think it's important just for our communication and to make sure we actually are perfectly on the same page. So one point is one that Mark Siegel actually raised yesterday in the discussion on disclosures, and it's the fact that we sort of say quite starkly that the development of the principle about the location of information in the primary financial statements and then the notes is in the primary financial statements project, which I think I agree with, but there must be some relationship between the way we're thinking about the disclosure initiative and how we draft disclosures with a sort of, we've got some idea we must be using in our heads about what, you know, the notes are about to do that. So I don't really think there's such a stark distinction between those two that we keep seeming to be saying. And the other thing is that I'm just interested to know when we're talking about because I think one of the challenges we've got is because of all of these different pieces of the Better Communications Project, and then we've got all of these sub-strands, which all sort of make sense if you're working on a day-to-day basis. But, for example, when we talk about the... We say in paragraph 24 there's a separate project on targeted standards levels review of disclosures, which is true. There's a separate strand of work on that. And then we say in paragraph 27, so now there are only two topics remaining in the principles of disclosure project. But the standards level review of disclosures is still part of the principles of disclosure project umbrella, isn't it? So that's sort of when we... I'm really asking you how you want me to communicate it when I'm talking to the outside world. Are we saying, are you saying that we should end up with a... So we've got a principles of disclosure project, and one part of that project is the targeted standards level review of disclosures, or are we saying that's a separate project?
That's not how we are viewing it. So I'll tell you how we're thinking about it, and it might be that the board would prefer us to articulate it differently. The principles of disclosure, you know, based on what was in the DP, essentially, of course, contained a lot of different stuff rather than one sort of coherent piece of direction. And we feel that what we ended up doing in March was taking out everything where the board had a clear direction to move forward and putting it in the relevant project. So a targeted standards level review of disclosure is in my view, a separate project because we've pulled it out from the myriad of other stuff that we were thinking about. The reason that pod almost still exists, given that we see it as having been a vehicle to take all the issues we have with disclosure and decide how to carry them forward, is because at the moment there are a few of those issues which we are still to make next step decisions about and decide what we're going to do and where they belong.
And the reason why I'm being picky, though, and I don't have it in front of me, but I'm pretty confident that slides that I've been looking at that most recently we're presenting in terms of the Better Communications Project, we still have the blocks of primary financial statements, disclosure initiative and taxonomy. And under disclosure initiative, we've still got this as one of the pillars.
Yes, so we at the moment, disclosure initiative is kind of an umbrella that encompasses principles of disclosure, targeted standards level review and definition of material. But those three each are individual projects with clear
But they're still under, we're still presenting them in those slides as being under the principles of disclosure umbrella.
No, they're under the disclosure initiative umbrella.
Oh, sorry. Okay, all right. So I'm confusing myself. Yeah, okay, thank you.
Hopefully.
Chambu.
Thank you. Similar question, so I agree with I'm happy with all your recommendations. On paragraph 29, I'm following Sue's comment. Maybe if you see the B, then you are going to choose another label for the... is that right? You are saying whether the disclosure initiative label is good for the next...
I mean, I think the point we're trying to highlight there is, I mean, obviously, depending on what the board decides to do with what's left under principles of disclosures, which is location of information and accounting policies, if, you know, we don't do anything within those specific labels, all that's going to be left under disclosure initiative is targeted standards level review and definition of material. So definition of material, rather. So it's a question for the board to decide whether that label of disclosure initiative is still going to be something to leave, since that there would probably only be two strands of specific work left.
So you would like to change some kind of a labeling to focus what is described, what we're going to do?
I think potentially the situation we find ourselves in is that we have had a degree of feedback that the labeling is a bit confusing. And we think that is entirely understandable given the range of different things that are going on, as we discussed back in March. At the moment, because we haven't entirely resolved everything that was in pod and decided on next steps in everything, we feel it's a bit premature to reduce that labelling. And what we anticipate is that once we've made all of the next step decisions that we're due to make in July, and once we've got to a point where definition of material perhaps is very close to finalisation, there may well be scope to simplify the way we're describing all of this, which is what part B of that paragraph is all about.
Mary?
Like both Chungwu and Sue, overall, to use the test of the paper, I'm happy. But I did have also a couple of questions, just a question of suggestion. The suggestion is to think very carefully about how much we peel things out and say this is now a separate standalone item. And I'm thinking particularly of the targeted standards level review, because if we say it becomes a project about, you know, let's say it's IS-15, and I pick it because it isn't, you know, there isn't one. You know. No, that was deliberate. You know, let's say it's about, then it becomes a project to look again at IS-15, and there's a lot more pressure for scope creep to think again about recognition and measurement, et cetera, as opposed to if we keep it packaged within these are the targeted standards level review, it, you know, that we're doing for the purpose of, you know, the, you know, testing the guidance developed for the board. I think I'm not saying we should keep the label pod, but I think rather than making them two standalone projects, it then becomes about the standard, and I think it creates additional pressure for scope creep beyond looking at the disclosures. So that's I think when we think about messaging it, that's I want to make clear that the targeted standards level review, while we should get improvements in the standard itself, that's not the primary reason we're doing it to test the drafting guidance. And I think reminding ourselves of that as well as others is good. And then the other is a question. I just can't remember where something got parked. It's in the principles of disclosure, there were some high-level principles for how preparers could improve the effectiveness of disclosure. And I think there was some concern that they were too high-level to make a difference as they were. You know, what some might call motherhood and apple pie. But I don't want to lose them because I think they were valuable reminders. I don't think we have to do a lot more work. I don't want to develop them and say this means this, this means this, you know, lots of application guidance. But have they just fallen between the cracks, or am I just forgetting a decision that we made about where those go?
That really comes back to the March decisions. So the principles of effective communication that you are referring to fell within the bucket of stuff that in March we presented to the board as these are all things that could help solve the central disclosure problem. We kind of need to decide what the first most effective step is, which is how we got to the whole targeted standards level review process. At that point, you know, the board did not decide that it would not be looking again at principles of effective communication. It decided to prioritise what is currently happening under targeted standards level review. So that's not to say we can never look at them again. And certainly, for example, when we come back early next year to think about the effect of some of the recent publications and what's happening out there practically, that might be an opportunity to also think about is there anything else we might do, but at the moment we are not doing anything active.
Okay, because I think they were not sufficient and we're not going to drive specific changes, but they were good framing reminders about things. And if, for example, just going to another project, primary financial statements ends up with us doing significant rewrite of IS-1, I would think incorporating some of those very high level principles without a lot of deliberation and development might be good. So I just don't want to lose sight of them.
Okay. We'll keep the back burner inside. Jen Chow.
Thank you, Hans. I'm happy with staff's proposal. I think the proposal clarify a lot, and it's really helpful to understand and manage those projects. I just have one observation with regard to the materiality project. Currently, the staff proposed to fall within the disclosure initiative, but that part mainly focus on the notes to the financial statement. I understand the reason you said in paragraph 34, but I'm still thinking that whether it is appropriate or clear enough, because materiality applied to whole of the financial statement, not only limited to the notes to the financial statement. So if we limit it to that simply to the notes of the financial statement, maybe people will question whether it still applied to other parts of the financial statement. So I'm thinking that whether we should be thinking whether that part should be included in the disclosure initiative.
Councillor Azar?
I agree with the staff proposal. I just have one word of caution about how the management commentary is referred to. And when we say that it focuses on improving the content of information provided outside, I think we should, at this stage, say some of the information provided. And I guess one part of the update will be to consider the scope.
I'm trying to be helpful, not difficult, even though it might not appear so. So the fact that, now I'm embarrassed with the point I made before, because now when I reread the paragraphs, it's obvious, but I think the fact that I'm a geek and I've got, this is my day job and I'm still getting confused is probably an indication of something. And also, I know that I was asked last week, somebody said to me last week, I can't believe you guys have dropped the disclosure initiative. So they thought because we're sort of communicating that aspects of POD have been moved and there's not much left, that that means we're not doing anything. So I then went through the explanation of, no, we're prioritising the things where we get the biggest wins. But I think we've got a big communication challenge. That's my only message. And so I guess my 30,000-level question for you, just reflecting on my own misstep and that comment, is I completely agree that this articulation about the primary financial statements, what the focus of that is and what the focus of the disclosure initiative is about the notes and that sort of general distinction is really helpful for thinking about the general split and interactions between the different parts. But are we going to make our communication job and understanding for people harder or less hard by then slicing and dicing ever more finely what's in disclosure initiative or not? So sort of building on Mary's point a little bit, do we help or hinder by starting to say, well, there's a disclosure initiative and under this banner we've got very specifically this materiality project, this targeted level review of standards, which then might get further bifurcated or in two or three bits into other sub-projects. By doing these more and more and more granular distinctions, when we've already got the challenge of explaining what's under the whole better communications banner, are we actually making our lives more and other people's lives more difficult or less difficult? Or are we better just to say, for example, that the disclosure initiative is about the notes and the things we're thinking about in that context are a targeted standards level review, you know, and just listing off what the different aspects are without sort of formally labelling them as projects? Because I'm wondering whether all of the slicing and dicing is actually making it harder to communicate rather than easier to communicate.
So is this about avoiding the word project?
Well, yes, because we're getting into now all of these binary... So the discussion I had with the staff about is the disclosure, you know, what's left in POD versus what's in the drafting and how that all interacts with the disclosure initiative is because we're focusing on all of these sub-projects.
Some of the feedback...
So I don't know. Yeah, it's a genuine question because I'm getting confused.
I think it genuinely is confusing because we've got multiple layers of stuff going on. We've got the better communication, then we've got everything under the better communication, then disclosure initiative has got stuff underneath that.
And now we're doing more and more and more of it.
And one thing that we heard for a long time, actually, is that the badge disclosure initiative has been causing confusion, and actually putting the better communication label over the top has just added to it because you're adding those additional layers. One thing that we were wondering, and I think it's covered in paragraph 29, is that when we've gone through all the process of scoping exactly what we're doing on the principles of disclosure, whether actually the disclosure initiative label disappears and all you end up with is probably maybe two topics that were previously labelled the disclosure initiative. Now, that's not something we're asking you about today, but I think that's something that might actually clarify the communication. I know that's different from what you were suggesting, which is to say that actually we've got disclosure initiative and we've got all this going on underneath, but I think in a few months' time we may be in a situation where actually we have relatively little left under the badging of disclosure initiative, and whether having that as a overarching label might actually just be adding to the confusion.
But I think one of the challenges we might have doing this when we've been working on the disclosure initiative now for several years is that comment that the person made to me, so you guys have dumped the disclosure initiative.
Well,
it's a challenge.
I think.
But if you just look at Appendix A, which is the original 10-point plan, there is four accomplished, ongoing green to on the right top on material, we're going to finish today, right? And so that's five out of five, and then then it says what is still ongoing. So the charge that we have dropped, we have completed it, and there is still a little bit left. Isn't that the best way to communicate it?
I think that's exactly how we would look to message it. It's not that we're dropping the disclosure initiative. It's that actually we've completed most of what we said we were actually going to be doing as part of the disclosure initiative.
But we all understand that. I think our communication is quite complicated.
I think in our slides we can probably do a better job of being very clear that under disclosure initiative we had POD that then spun off into target standards level review, definition of materiality, board guidance. But I think there's a benefit to keeping the projects separate because the delivery of each of those projects is going to be different. So I think if we lump it all together under one project, it's going to be challenging. And then I just checked our website. The other thing that we do, and maybe we can look at making this more prominent, we say disclosure initiative - targeted standards level review. So we can keep that word disclosure initiative very prominent so people understand it's still a subset of the greater project.
I don't think that should be a problem. If there's anything that we ditched, it's probably principles of disclosures, right?
I think
that was never in the original plan to begin with.
We haven't. We've just sort of...
Right. I would say spun off into
different words. We haven't ditched it, because I think that...
It's spun off.
Because one of the things that's coming out of the disclosure, the POD,
too many titles.
Is the standards level review. Yeah. That came out of POD. Yeah.
But in itself, the message, better communication in financial reporting consists of four different items. That is not difficult to communicate.
Until you start getting into all the 10 components within it.
I don't know. Primary financial statements, very clear. Management commentary, well, that's a challenge in itself, but in I've stick some. So disclosure initiative is the only thing that may be a little bit problematic, but we've finished half of it. And there's some stuff left. I mean, how difficult can that be? I would have no problem explaining that we didn't ditch it. No, it is more than half done.
I think possibly one thing to keep in mind is that, you know, the whole segregation of targeted standards level review was in itself a direct response to the feedback we had about POD. So it's not as if we've abandoned it.
I know that. It's the communication.
POD was, we went out, that was the DD, and then everything in POD gets dealt with. So the term that disappears is POD, because we've taken that somewhere else. So we have better communication, we have disclosure initiative, and we have the chart in Appendix A. POD goes.
Yeah. Nick, yeah.
Thank you. I think I broadly agree with what others said. Now that we've narrowed down the focus of POD, it's clearer in terms of which components are looking at what, and the interaction is clearer. I think what we have to remember, though, that there is a fundamental interaction between these components, and also, you know, we need to give a sense of coherence here as well, and not lose that. So as much as we can slice and dice it, it's an overall package that these elements interact between each other.
Amaro?
It's similar to Nick's, and so I was driving my attention to Appendix A on how to communicate, and maybe how open are we to actually... The confusion to me when I try to explain this is apparent. There are actions that are permanent actions, like the point 8, use less prescriptive wording as new standards are issued. So these are permanent actions. These are not really a project. So it may be the case for us to review what were really in the 10-point plan, what we're really talking about projects, things that we start, we research, we finish, we complete, and things that are really identified as permanent efforts for the board and for the boards to come. Then I think would be easier. It's at least this is how I explain. Because we either keep this open forever, because using less prescriptive wording is forever, and or we at some point we stopped and incorporate this in our daily job. So I don't have my if I were looking at the 10-point, if we understand that under the 10-point we conclude the materiality, and we accept that the primary financial statements project will take over of this particular aspect, I would suggest us thinking about providing final feedback on this and then incorporating these permanent practices in our daily job, because otherwise we'll be forever open.
Well, but I think if once we have developed this, once we have gone through this exercise of developing guidance for the board, etc., then we can also tick off 8, because then we have established the principles how to do that, and of course, yeah, take that on board in future standard setting. But the job has been done, so I think we can tick off all the items on the list at a certain point,
and then close it with a feedback statement.
The only thing that, you know, people might have expected, which is not likely to happen, is that miraculously 50% of disclosures disappear as a result of this exercise.
And don't get me wrong, I don't feel strongly. I was just, sometimes we keep going down a path and then we never question it. So.
Okay.
But we are going to think about what the role of the notes is, aren't we, when we're doing the disclosures?
Okay, do we agree with the stats proposal?
14. Okay, moving on then, we are now going to go to the targeted standards level review of disclosures. And the first part of that we will be discussing is guidance for the board. We actually have two papers on this, which is 11B and 11C. 11B is largely an update of a paper we provided last month, and that paper is really there just for context as we make decisions about individual steps in the process each month. So we don't propose talking through the information in 11B again. Instead, it's just really there for your information. So to talk about step two of guidance for the board in 11C, over to Siobhan.
Okay, so in May 2018, the board tentatively decided to base all disclosure requirements on one or more specific disclosure objectives and draft all disclosure requirements in a way that clearly links each specific item of information included in disclosure requirements with the related objectives. The board also tentatively decided to continue to use high-level disclosure objectives in IFRS standards to support the more specific disclosure objectives. So this brings us to the next stage of our analysis. In particular, Agenda Paper 11C focuses on the board's process for developing disclosure objectives and requirements. The primary objectives of the proposed approach are to ensure that the disclosure objectives and requirements are based on stakeholder needs, are considered throughout the life of the project, and that the knowledge and experience of the IFRS taxonomy team is being used effectively. In the staff analysis and recommendations, we have summarized an approach that aims to achieve each of these objectives whilst retaining flexibility to be adapted for different types of board project. For example, some of the steps described in the paper may be approached differently when the board is developing disclosure requirements for a new standard compared to when it is developing minor amendments to an existing standard. So the first part of the paper discusses the IFRS taxonomy team. We think that effectively leveraging the knowledge and experience of the IFRS taxonomy team should be a key part of the board's process for developing disclosure objectives and requirements. Consequently, our first recommendation is that the IFRS taxonomy team is engaged in an advisory capacity to help the project teams better understand and assess those items listed in paragraph 14. So question one in the paper asks the board whether they agree with the staff recommendation, and I will hand over to the board for discussion before moving on to the next part of the paper.
Sure.
I strongly support this recommendation to involve the taxonomy team for a couple of reasons. Opening their list. Firstly, I know that whenever I have any questions about whether we require particular disclosures or how they might look under our existing standards, I always talk to the taxonomy team because they know our disclosure requirements so well. So I think they've got a great source of knowledge. Secondly, the other thing I think where they can really help us is with the clarity and the specificity of our drafting, because they've got a very good ability to say, okay, you've said this, this means that. And sometimes I've had many, as you know, on the staff, when I was on the staff, moments of, oh, that's not what I meant, when they have sort of translated what I meant into what that means from a disclosure perspective. So I think it's a really good idea to use their knowledge. My only question is a capacity one, given I know that they're not sort of sitting around twiddling their thumbs now, but I completely support the idea.
Jen Chow.
Thank you. As Sue said, I also strongly support that because I think having technology support or technology thinking during we develop our standards, it's really necessary and helpful, very important. Just one clarification. Our intention is to try to bring IFRS taxonomy team in and provide support when we develop the disclosure requirements. So whether there will be, I think there will be involving this, our standard setting relevant to those disclosure-related standards, or all of, because the question you ask is that they will be assigned to each of the board's active project. So it's all of projects or those, you know, disclosure-related projects.
So with this approach, we think it's important that initially every project team has the chance to liaise with a member of the IFRS taxonomy team. And from that liaison, it will then be decided, I guess, the extent to which the IFRS taxonomy team will be involved in all of the stages of the project. So for more minor amendments in standards, it might be that the IFRS taxonomy team is not needed because there will be no changes to disclosure. However, in other cases where we're creating new standards, they might have a higher level of involvement because disclosures will be impacted.
Yeah, but I'm thinking that most of the standards do have separate disclosure requirements. Maybe in some cases, those standards only relevant to the recognition and measurement. So in this case, maybe I'm not sure whether we still need them to involve in those project.
Yeah. I mean, what the recommendation comes down to essentially is that what we are suggesting is that the IFRS taxonomy team are involved in the decision about their involvement every time. So what project teams are not doing is going, oh, you know, there's no benefit from their involvement because of the particular nature of this project. We would always, you know, have someone allocated to be part of the team to have those discussions, and it might be in certain circumstances that those discussions lead to a conclusion that for a particular project the involvement might be less than others, but we would think those discussions should always be occurring.
Gary?
Thank you. By the way, Catherine, to your team, a very well-written set of collective papers for all the papers. I actually strongly support this, too, but I think Sue's on the right point about capacity of taxonomy team is I don't think every project needs an embedded taxonomy person. I mean, maybe projects where the output is a discussion paper might not be necessary, or definition materiality, which will be eventually be a final standard, wouldn't need it. So I would just sort of challenge the team, you know, which is the XBRL team, how many people can you actually put into how many projects? The reason why I think it's important is, you know, at the end of the day, our work product is instructions to prepare us financial statements. That's what standards are. And the XBRL team is the closest group in this organization to actually executing these our decisions into action, is they're actually setting it up for how a preparer is going to fill it in. So for that reason, I think it's especially important is in general, you know, might vary project to project, but I think as a matter of principle, and you know, I think it's an important recommendation. I fully support it.
Saza.
I also support the proposal that the taxonomy team would be in an advisory capacity every time we develop disclosures. And that's probably the way I would phrase the recommendation. The fact that it's a particular person that will be that it could be decided by the IFRS taxonomy to allocate one particular person, maybe the why the IFRS taxonomy will be involved, but I would not put the onus on the fact that you have one person that is allocated. And in implementing this very important recommendation, I think discussion should be had with the IFRS taxonomy a bit further to see how best this involvement would take place, but that doesn't mean that one person in particular would participate in all sorts of meetings that take place in a particular project. So in other words, my words of caution are making sure that we get the full advisory capacity that we really need, ensuring that we do not build some form of bureaucracy in the process.
If I could just add something, because we've had a few comments along similar lines, and just in case it helps with understanding our thinking at all, I would highlight paragraph 13 A and B, where we do talk about some of the points that Siobhan raised earlier in response to Chinchero's question. Essentially, the way we see this is that if the board were to vote for our recommendation today, it wouldn't be that tomorrow we would go to the taxonomy team and say, please give us a person for every single active project that the board has. We see it very much as part of what will be involved in the testing that will be later in the year in terms of how to work together and make that happen. And just to reiterate also the point about the advisory is more to make sure those discussions happen at the beginning of the project. But I think your suggestions are sensible and will certainly...
I agree with staff's recommendation, maybe almost same point, but let me ask in this way. So we are going to discuss in July about the cross-standard issue. Yeah. So I think the taxonomy team may help the cross-standard issue like duplication or inconsistency all across other standards. So... What is your timeline about revisiting all other standards? Because there should be a lot of inconsistency or maybe duplication or some similar disclosure but slightly differently articulated. So all these small things, but if you go through, it may take time. And I would think taxonomy team may have noticed some of the inconsistent wording and difficult to put it into the taxonomy. So they may have a knowledge. So how do you incorporate their knowledge into our work to all other standards? And what is your timeline?
But I don't think we've asked the staff to do that.
No, you haven't. So the paper that we are planning to bring next month, at risk of making comments about a paper that is not yet finalised, will talk about drafting and dealing with inconsistencies in a forward-looking way. Yeah. So what we are trying to do with this whole process is improve the way that the board develops and drafts requirements in future. What the board did not decide to do in March was a comprehensive review of all standards. So at this point, we aren't planning to reopen every standard. We're planning to come up with proposals that would help to make things consistent in all cases going forward in future and review the particular standards that we select, but we aren't planning to do a comprehensive rewrite of all the disclosures.
We do not have any plan yet, but in the future, maybe taxonomy team may help bring, clear out inconsistency and the minor differences.
If we were to do a project like that, then yes, that would be helpful.
Okay.
We're talking about prospective application.
Yeah, I agree with Gary's point that there is capacity issue, I guess. So before, I guess, you better talk with our taxonomy team before finalizing this, even though you said that there is a kind of limit, a few projects, but currently they are helping us for a long time. There is a kind of system of a cooperation between taxonomy and us. So that system has been working very well, but you are adding another kind of a layer to put one of them in a whole process. So it's a little different. So before finalizing, we need to listen to taxonomy team idea how to, you know, improve the current existing process. So that would be good, helpful to you.
I think that's very right, correct. What I would say actually is that the feedback that we've consistently got from the taxonomy team and indeed from project teams is that we've been involving the taxonomy team far too late in the process. And what Catherine's team has designed here is a method of actually getting them involved much earlier in the process so that they can actually have a positive effect on the presentation and disclosure requirements, because in the past it's their input has been too late to really be effective.
So theoretically that's correct, but however, does create some kind of the increase in capacity we should have?
Well, that's for the management to figure out.
We are actively looking at different opportunities.
That's not something we have to solve as a board. That's why we have Nilly.
No pressure.
We're on it.
Well, I just wanted to say that I think in involving the taxonomy team earlier, we're going to save time for them also. They need to be more efficient in what they do. So that is a positive factor.
Problem solved. Very good comment, yeah. Okay. I think we support the staff recommendation. Yeah. Yes?
14. Okay, so the second recommendation, the board adopt the 5-step process to developing disclosure objectives and requirements as described in paragraphs 20 to 40. In summary, this approach involves the consideration of disclosure objectives and requirements at all stages of the project. The approach also places significant focus on processes aimed at understanding the needs of users of financial statements and other stakeholders. As with all the board's activities, we think this is an essential part of the process. In particular, we think that the activities described in the paper will help the board to develop effective disclosure objectives and requirements, find an appropriate balance between costs and benefits, and fully understand the effects of all disclosure proposals. Does the board agree with the staff recommendation that the board should use the 5-step approach to developing disclosure objectives and requirements as described in paragraphs 20 to 40?
When I look at it's not a decision tree, but the 5 steps, then you look at the first step, isn't that the step that we have to take for every standard setting activity generally?
Yes, it is. I mean, just to clarify the approach here, there is a number of things in this paper, and we do say it in one of the opening paragraphs, that are similar to some things that are in the due process handbook for standard setting generally. Yeah. But what we wanted to do was make sure that we had on paper for our testing process effectively a complete process for the development of disclosure requirements so that it was coherent and all in one place.
Okay, but
there are elements of this that are...
Step one is sort of integrated in the, you start a project, first you go to try to understand why it's necessary, etc. And then the distinction between step two and step three. Step four is clear, that's also, you know, nothing new, but it doesn't have to be new, but you know, that is a clear step. Step five, I think, is something that we probably don't do enough. So I think that's also a good addition. But the distinction between step two and step three, clear to me.
In many cases, the exercise of listening to stakeholders and the board discussing what they believe is required in light of recognition and measurement, where that's the nature of the project, may well be happening at similar times. However, given what was decided last month about objectives, we feel that the step around listening to stakeholders, and particularly at an early stage, the users of financial statements, is so absolutely fundamental and integral to achieving improvements in the way we develop disclosure requirements that we think it should be pulled out as a separate consideration every time.
Sue?
I agree with the general approach that you've got here, just a few observations. So, and they sound pickier than they are, but just suggestions. So I think we need to be a little bit, realistic is the wrong word, but I think I certainly agree that in step two that we need to make sure we understand what it is that investors and users of financial statements are interested in and how they consume information. But I think if I read this cold, I get a bit too much of a sense, and it's probably not what you meant, but I think there's a risk that there's a sense that we expect to find the answers when we talk to the users out there. And I think sometimes we are much more have to be in much more in a leadership role. And that's because sometimes it's, if I use insurance as an example, because the model's so different to what a lot of investors have had to use before, we had to develop a lot of the thinking. So, of course, we needed to understand, you know, what it is that they're interested in about the business. But then we sort of had to take that initial idea and then go and develop it a lot ourselves from a disclosure perspective. So I think there's more in step three, I think, that needs to be us sort of reflecting on what we've heard and then really developing it based on what we ourselves think and the accounting that we've come up with. So that, I thought, was a little bit underplayed. Also, I think we need to be a little bit more, a little bit realistic about how much time and effort we can expect from investors and users in the market, because if it's a big, sexy project, then, you know, and it's a topic they're interested in, I'm thinking primary financial statements, it's easy to get meetings and lots of engagements. There's lots of projects we do that it's quite challenging to get users really that excited and talking to us. And so I think we're going to have to be a little bit pick and choose a little bit about when we really think we need their input and when we don't so much, so that we don't, you know, get investor fatigue, if you like, in terms of getting input into our projects. So maybe Nick will disagree with that, but in my experience, if you keep coming back, particularly on the same project, I think one of the challenges we have is, you know, we've got all of these phases and we want feedback from them at all these phases, and then like, you're back again talking about lease accounting. I've talked to you about that before, you know, but, you know, to us it's different, but it's so subtle to them. And the other thing is on timing. I completely agree with you. There's a general proposition that we need to think about disclosure along the way and not wait until we've finished everything else and then do one paper on disclosure to exaggerate. But there will be some things where we do need to do some of the development right at the last end, or at the later ends of projects. Thinking about leasing again, Catherine, looking at you. Some of the stuff that we had to come up with in the end on disclosure was as a consequence of some of the decisions we'd made on recognition and measurement. So, for example, because we simplified the measurement and took out some of the options in the measurement, which was captured on the balance sheet, we needed to develop very bespoke disclosure requirements that focused in on the bits of the optionality in the leases that hadn't been captured in the measurement. So some of that necessarily is done relatively late in the project, because it's a consequence of changes in the recognition and measurement decisions. So I know, I completely agree we need to think about it sooner, but some of it will still, I think, necessarily be quite late, just because what we're developing is changing and therefore the disclosure that's needed to support it needs to change at the last minute sometimes too.
Yeah, on step four, I was a little bit confused on paragraph 35, where you say, this definitely performs this cost-benefit analysis is very late in the process. And I'm asking myself, is that right? Because I think we could be better and have to do a little bit more earlier in the process. Because I think when we only get feedback after the exposure draft, I think it's very, very late. Because then we have developed a lot of interrelationship between measurement, disclosure, and everything. And then people come very late and raising cost-benefit. But you said, and then in the second half of this paragraph, the team may also decide to design a dedicated outreach program to gather feedback on a proposed disclosure objectives and requirements. And I think that is then in an earlier state. And I think really we need that for a kind of big projects which we undertake. We need that earlier engagement of getting better information on cost benefit. Because man, that is a kind of where we, I think, have this lot of discussion now, why we have the disclosure initiative. People think it is too much. I don't think it is too less. I'm not really, I think we have to do it very early in the project and to be better on that. And to be better on that, I think the necessary step is to get stakeholders earlier involved in that, not in this late stage, because man, always we're doing that, we're discussing measurement recognition, and then in the last board meeting we're discussing disclosure, and then we go into an exposure draft. And then we got the feedback too late. And I think that is, I think, necessary that we're getting this step really done earlier.
Yeah, if I may respond, I love this topic. I can't resist expanding a little. Just to in case it helps, we had a lot of debate and discussion amongst ourselves about effectively the distinction between step two and step four, in the sense that another way we could have gone about this would have been that step two would have been just users. We find out what users are looking for information-wise, potentially propose that in an ED or whatever the document might be, and then on the basis of those proposals get feedback from other stakeholders about the consequences of that and go to cost benefit. But for the exact reasons you describe, we felt that step two absolutely could not be limited to users, because it's so important to understand concerns of others from an early stage, which may involve excessive costs and such. So that's why that non-user part of step two is there. But equally, we feel that having made some well thought out proposals in an ED or whatever the document might be, it's absolutely essential in light of everyone having seen the same proposals on paper that we revisit that cost benefit, because it is so important.
It might be better if you, rather than creating the impression you go through all these steps subsequently, which in practice you will not do. In practice, it will be an iterative process, and you should indeed ask questions about cost benefit at a very early stage, and then test them later in the process again. So I think you have to present it differently. It is more like things to consider when drafting a disclosure requirements. Tak.
Thank you. Yeah, exactly this point. On the step two, I appreciate you put users' needs and the other stakeholders. It's mainly preparers and auditors. And then for users' needs, you incorporated some of my comments in the last month. I really appreciate that. But for the other stakeholders' needs, I would like to add two more. One is about the relevant population. I think relevant population is really important. Some of the disclosure could be very, very important for the very small number of entities, like a large financial institution. So some of the information about derivative could be very important, but it may not be very relevant to many other ordinary non-financial entities. So, of course, they can neglect those requirements exercising the materiality judgment. But IFRS covers all the entities, so they have to go through those requirements anyway for the audit purposes. So, therefore, when we make a standard, we have to keep that in our mind. And then the second point is whether the information is also useful to management. That is really important, because if it is useful to management as well, maybe preparer are willingly to prepare it, even if it is very costly. But if it is not useful to the management at all, preparer feel it's very expensive, even if the cost itself is very low. So the whether or not it is useful to the management is really important. Having said that, normally the information which is useful to investor or users, normally useful to the management as well. So maybe it may be the matter of education to the management. But however, as long as management do not persuade it that it's useful to themselves, they feel it's very expensive.
Mary?
I have a couple of comments on specific stages, but biggest point is, overall, I think we should be articulating these steps, taking Hans' point about being iterative rather than, you know, you're done with one before you move on to the other, and framing it in terms of the structure of a project. Because it's, you know, I think rightly you said we are integrating things that may be relevant for other aspects of a project because we wanted to put it in context. But it still sounds like this is a process we're going through only for disclosure. And I think, actually, what I took from this is we have to think about how to integrate disclosure considerations into every step of a standard-setting project. And so I think if we say, here are the steps or maybe phases to make it more fuzzy outlines rather than, you know, sequence 1, 2, 3, and what are the considerations for disclosure in each of them. So it doesn't sound like, you know, we have Peter with responsibilities for research, where the research phase of a project is defining what the problem is and is it one we should be addressing, which is articulating the question, which is really what you have in step one. And I think it's more... And I don't want to make it sound like we have a whole separate process or structure for the disclosure aspect. But I think it really is saying, rather than waiting till you get down to the, you know, the last third of the project to start thinking about disclosure, you're trying to articulate what you have to do in day one to make sure we get the right information and then feed that information in. And then that picks up Sue's point about some of the decisions we make about disclosure. You can only make at the end, but you have to base it on an understanding you gain at the beginning of what's the total population of information needs that you may satisfy in different ways. One of the other points I had is similar to Martin's, or I think the same, which is we just say, you know, we don't turn on the switch to think about cost-benefit until step four. We won't have thought about what information, for example, we have to put into the exposure draft, you know, in terms of highlighting considerations about different approaches or alternatives. And then a third thing, just to think about perhaps associating with considerations for step three is auditability, which is a concern that the IAASB, you know, focuses on very often in their responses to our proposals. I don't think we should tick through every stakeholder's, you know, concerns in every one, but I think that's something we might do better to think about a bit more explicitly early on, so in case there are questions, we can solicit information about it. So,
Nick.
Thank you. I've got some comments on step two in particular. I think it's very important here that we do emphasise the role of primary users here. I agree with Sue, we have been mindful of investor fatigue, but equally where there isn't investor interest in a particular set of disclosures, there may be a message there in its own right, which we need to think about. But a couple of points which I think are really quite important in step two. So in paragraph 24, where you talk about DP and ED, I think it's very important that we don't entrench a two-step process here every time through this approach, that there may be occasions where we go straight to an exposure draft rather than always a DP followed by an ED. And I'd be nervous if this approach to disclosures entrenched that two-stage process on every occasion. So just a word of caution there. And then on the following paragraph, paragraph 25, I think it is good that we get investors to say, to differentiate between critical information and nice-to-have information. I think it's very important. But I don't think whether something's available outside of the financial statements or not should be an indicator of whether it's appropriate for it to be in the financial statements. I think that's a separate consideration. So I'd like to kind of drop that piece of distinction there, I think.
Gary.
Thank you. And I think all things considered, I actually like this document and the tone of it and the flow of it. Just really more some observations, as opposed to questions. Well, I think, you know, by the way, this is to my your plan. This is kind of classic, you know, business management tools. You know, problem statement, customer data, you know, resolution. I actually wonder: is step one and step two in the right order? And it may vary by project. Let me explain why. If Sue's comment is the way to think about this, that's the leadership, that sometimes the users don't really know what they want or can't necessarily really articulate well, we have to lead them to it. So that would kind of be, you know, a supply-push type concept. On the other hand, lots of business developments are, what does the market need, which is kind of step two. You know, maybe it may vary. Sometimes step one leads, sometimes step two leads, but ultimately it seems to me You start with what does the market want, which is what do stakeholders want and why. And then you sit there and then you define what is the issue and how we get from where we are to where they want. So just an observation, I think step two might frequently be step one. But on the other hand, again, reiterating what Sue said, maybe it is our leadership that's got to do it for them in large measure. Two, another comment I hadn't planned to make, but just want to second Martin's comment earlier. I think, in my way of thinking, an exposure draft, this is a done document. We think we are prepared to finalize this in the form as written. Everything's been thought through unless the feedback tells us it can't be done or it totally misses the mark or something like that. So if the exposure draft is our best foot forward, what do we think to do? It's got to have considered cost-benefit in the development of the exposure draft. I think it's more important there than it is the final standard. And then lastly, I don't see it in here, but I'm going to raise it, is one of the concerns to me is disclosures always seems to be the last thought at the very end of a project all too frequently here, and I think we should build it into the various deliberative steps. If you think of the standard project flow, you usually start off with, you know, once it gets through the research phase, we take the active standards, and the first thing is scope. You know, that says which transactions or types of entities are in or out. Then we typically go to recognition and measurement either together or separately, but there's an order in which we do things. So as we make votes, you know, it would be helpful to my way of thinking is what is the related disclosure of it? These projects come to last years. And by the time you get to disclosures, it tends to be a quick wrap-up, you know, weigh in. Half the people that were at the beginning of the project are not there then, don't even necessarily remember some of the earlier decisions. If that's the time to say, but you caveat, say, assuming the board agrees with our recommendations for, say, recognition measurement, and assuming it's material, and assuming the project finishes as it is, we would recommend the following types of disclosures. That's how I think we should manage. That's not in any of these papers. But I've said it, I think that's the right way we should try to do it. Will it be perfect? No. There'll always be the opportunity, maybe a need for a sweep to wrap up issues, but we should try.
Tom?
I want to make sure I kind of understand this. If I look at Appendix A, and I think kind of consistent with what Gary was saying, we're talking here about a project. This would be kind of applied to a brand new project. Is that right?
It's what we have tried to do is retain sufficient flexibility that it will be required whatever type of project we're looking at. So, does that answer your question?
Because I'm just thinking what we're going to. So, in particular, for three, where we say board consideration of disclosure at all project stages, understand. So there's a sense in here that we want to be, and kind of what Gary said, it was an afterthought sometimes at the end, that we want to be thinking about disclosure all the way through. And so that we're building disclosure at the same time as we're building recognition and measurement. If we were starting clean is what I'm understanding here. We're also going to be testing disclosure on some existing standards where we built the recognition and measurement. And so my kind of question or cautionary note is, the way we're going to test this isn't, so when we do it on a brand new project, it's going to be very, we're going to try and build this process with existing. So it'll be an incomplete test of the process by definition, because we won't be building anything simultaneously. We're thinking about disclosure where we've got the recognition measurement set. So I don't think it's a problem for this. I think this makes sense for the new project. I just kind of would comment on how much will this limit our learning, or what do we have to be cautious of when we go to do these tests, given that we're not integrating at this, or we're integrating disclosure with a fixed set of recognition measurement. Do you have kind of a comment to help me just with that? I just want to make sure I understand.
Yes, that is a very fair challenge and accurate in terms of the next step. I mean, the way we envisage the testing process in the second half of the year is that everything we've got here will be relevant in the same way it will be relevant if we were looking at a project that is an amendment rather than a standard, in the sense that where we talk about thinking about what is needed to support the proposed recognition and measurement, that would still be part of the discussions in terms of what is needed on disclosure. The bit that wouldn't happen would be that there would be no discussion about what the recognition and measurement should be for this to be at the same time of, but it doesn't prevent...
Yeah, and so, for example, and if you were in a wide open project, you might even have a choice between some recognition and disclosure, right? Whereas this isn't the case here. And that's absolutely off it. So some elements will by definition not, but I still think this is a very reasonable way to test it, but I just wanted to put in that sort of cautionary note. So I do understand. So this is still a plan, though, for a brand that we would apply to a brand new project, and that makes sense. Okay.
Jungbu.
Thank you. I generally agree with your recommendation, but could you check with this process, with our due process handbook we have? Actually, it's essentially quite a repetition of all the process in the handbook. And that's one thing. Another thing is, if you'd like to develop a specific process for disclosure, some standards, then as Nick or Tak said, there's a special things in disclosure issues. So if you can identify such kind of aspects, then you can add new process to the process the handbook, due process handbook is stipulating now. So that's the current process can be applied to any kind of development, not just the disclosure requirements, recognition, measurement, everything. You have to follow all this process according to our due process. That's one suggestion. Another thing is the DNE, the cost and benefit analysis and effect analysis. Actually, it's not easy to differentiate these two, cost benefits. It's just one of their effects and the effects, because when Alan Tyser was here, he developed the effects analysis paper it's about more than 100 pages. He described every possibility of effects analysis. So cost benefit is one of them. Even though there are our staff member who are writing the kind of effects analysis of new standards. Basically, we can include just the cost benefit side of the full effect, because it's not easy to evaluate the full effect of the standard. So my suggestion is think about the kind of combining the process D and E, and that's another suggestion.
If I could just mention one or two things that might be helpful. With regard to the due process handbook, just to confirm that we have sort of run this paper past the team that look after that to make sure we weren't doing anything that would be considered problematic, but it's probably also worth reiterating that all we are doing at this stage is developing an approach to test. So at this stage, I wouldn't want to suggest that we are doing things that would become formal due process if the board were to vote this in right now. The other thing I just wanted to mention, and it's relevant to a lot of the comments that have been raised, so for example, your question about the interaction between step 4 and 5, in terms of what we are doing moving forward, we've heard a lot of feedback today, including this iterative nature of the process, and that perhaps consequential steps is not the most helpful. What we are planning to do is, in September, when all decisions on all steps of the guidance for the board have been made, we're going to summarise them all in one paper, and what we will make sure that we do is take all of the feedback we've heard today on board and try and articulate better, if you like, what is proposed in that paper to reflect the comments. So we will make sure that all of that is thought about as we move.
Thank you. I mean, a few points, and I must say that they have been at least partly made by others. I think one point of reference that I find is missing in this is the reference to the methodology on how to analyze the effects that we have received as a recommendation. We said that we would follow And this effect analysis is in fact something that should be conducted throughout our due process. So it's valid for the cost. It's, and Gary and Martin and Shabula referred to that. I think that's important to have. I mean, it's these, our conclusion on the effects are something that we should seek comments on at exposure draft stage. The second point I wanted to make is that I think part of the uneasiness that we have and that has already been highlighted is the fact that these different steps, whether we call them steps or tasks that need to be performed throughout a project, indeed are valid for other elements than disclosures. So I agree with two things that I think this paper I think is aiming at doing. Is first, I agree that disclosures is not something that you leave to the end, but that I think it's very useful that you have identified at the various steps, various tasks that we perform in a project, how what needs to be done that has an impact on the disclosure requirements that we're going to write. So the summarized recommendation, in a way, loses sight of what is the real added value of this paper. And that's the way you describe everything that has been done, I support. The third point I wanted to make is that what I feel is could have been referred to as well. I mean, you have this emphasis in the way you developed your proposal on the disclosures that support measurement requirements when they are discussed. And I agree to that, but to me that's eventually too strong an emphasis. I think we have to be guided by the content of the notes altogether and what supports measurement and recognition is just part of it.
Daryl.
So a couple of things, and it may be that I've become confused as the conversation's gone on. I support a lot of the individual elements that people are picking up on, but Catherine, your conclusion in particular worried me a little bit, or the partial conclusion that you expressed a little bit earlier when you were responding to Chungwu. I think that the sequential nature of these steps, the way you set out these steps, is very useful. I do agree with others that say it's iterative, that there are times when you're going to circle back and relook at something, but I don't think that changes the way that you set out the steps, and I don't think it changes necessarily the order. And just on, for example, the cost discussion, I think it's a useful discussion. In step two, under what my understanding of paragraph 27 is that paragraph 27 is very explicit that in step two you think quite seriously about costs, fully understand the cost consequences, etc., understand all of those parts. And I think that's the right place to be doing it, very early in the process. Maybe what this should be doing is emphasizing slightly more, instead of labeling preparers and regulators as other, maybe we should say that these are the people we should be talking to, but I think that's the right place. Step four, the cost-benefit analysis, I think you can only really do a cost-benefit analysis once you have the whole package. So a disclosure requirement may on its own appear incredibly onerous, but if it is simply disclosing a measurement requirement that we've decided is worthwhile, then we've already spent a lot of the money in developing the measurement and survey. So you need to be seeing that whole package together, and I think the cost-benefit process coming towards the end of the is looking at the different moving parts of the whole thing. I would be very cautious about anything that suggests that we need to be more explicit in a discussion paper, because I think we risk moving towards the idea that a discussion paper actually becomes exposure draft one and exposure draft two comes later. So I kind of like this. I think there are things like understanding the iterative nature of it, but I still think the sequence makes sense to me.
Sure.
I understand. Sorry, I agree with just about all of the comments that various people have made, and certainly the.
Is that possible?
Well, I don't think they've been contrary. I think they've mostly been complementary. Maybe not the sequencing versus iterative so much, but the idea that you need to think about costs earlier on, we need to understand the preparer perspective as well as the user one, and all of this stuff. But I think that my only sort of caution listening to all of this is that I think we need to be careful not to build something where we've locked ourselves into, this is the steps we have to do. It has to be done in this order. We have to do all of these steps. And somehow, if we haven't done all of these things in a particular way for every project, we've failed our due process. Because there's a risk it might end up being that. So I think we need to make sure that we come up with some... I think all of these aspects are really sensible things. All of these things are things we should be thinking about. We should be thinking about them earlier on in projects. And I completely agree with that. But I wonder whether we need to be so specific about, you know, you have to do this and it has to be in this order and all of this stuff. Because then how, for example, are we going to make it scalable? So we have some projects which are going to be tiny, narrow scope amendments where there could be disclosure aspects. And then we've got something like the insurance project. And we can't have, you know, it's very hard to come up with a stepped process that works for all of those things if we make it too formal and start making it a due process requirement and things. I think it's rather better articulate, and these are all of the disciplined aspects we should think of, and we should, some of them make it more principles-based maybe is what we should be going for, which I think would accommodate all of the sensible comments that have been made, and then we need to sort of explain what the objective of doing all of this is, because I'm scared we're going to straitjacket ourselves and then suddenly we're going to be held to account to something that just doesn't make sense for the circumstances.
So I think what you're saying is we're looking for objectives and principles rather than prescriptive.
And scalability, because we're hearing the same thing on effects analysis at the moment. There's this sort of perception that we only do an effects analysis at the end of a project because we produce one big document with a glossy cover, whereas we do think of effects all along the way, but because we're not articulating it in that sort of scalable way, we're sort of creating our own challenges.
Anne?
I like the five steps, but when I read the five steps, it's like something we'd be doing for a project anyway. It, you know, as we looked at a project, we'd be thinking through these steps. And say, if I look at the steps and I think about DRM, you think, oh, we're thinking about this, this, this. So I wonder if you can think, what is different in what you're proposing in the five steps that you wouldn't be doing anyway when you were doing a project? Or what's the extra thing you're finding, or what's the difference? And one way you might approach that is, say you sat down with the DRM team and you know they talked about the steps they were doing. I wonder how much commonality as they plan their project and go through these steps are the same as the steps you're talking about. Will that help you find what the point of difference is? What is it, this special thing, this special thing about disclosure that you're going after, and whether doing that might help you identify what it is and what makes these five steps different from five steps in general that we do when we run a project.
What's the response to that? Because as I've been sitting here, I've been thinking about the rate reg project and the DRM project. Are we actually thinking about disclosures early enough, even in those live projects at the moment?
Well, but also the question is justified. Can't we only start thinking about disclosures once we know that the model works? I mean, wouldn't it be a waste of energy to think about the disclosures at the DRM at this stage? Well, when we are not even sure that we are going to get a working model.
No, but I think we should always be thinking back to what are the investor needs. That should be our anchor.
I mean, you can see things already in DRM, oh, that'll be a disclosure and that'll be a disclosure.
Yeah.
But you can see them coming, even though we're not necessarily articulating that way. And I think behind that is, you know, well, why would that be a disclosure? Oh, well, users need to.
But I think in both cases, it's completely justified not to possibly waste energy on disclosure requirements when we... I think with the rate regulation, we know by now it's probably going to work with DRM. But a long time, we didn't know if it was going to work. Are these assets, are these liabilities? We didn't know.
But maybe in thinking about the next development phase of this team, it would be good to think about something like rate reg and think about, given the stage of a development it's at now, what would, to Anne's point, what would we do similarly or differently? If we were to adopt this thinking, what do we actually mean in that sort of, in a tangible environment?
That's a good test. Mary?
If I look at Appendix A as it's drafted now, my suggestion reflecting on today's discussion is recast this. First, starting with the title, it's not an approach. This is far more than an approach to developing disclosure objectives and requirements. This is considerations and standard setting, you know, kind of thing. And so, so what I suggest, and I think it is helpful to articulate things in steps or phases. And so the basic structure is here, but I think it's what's the objective of each phase? What are the typical considerations and steps that you take? So typical consideration in step one might be, you know, identifying the problem, assessing whether it's one that, you know, I'm articulating things for research, articulating what the problem is, whether it's, you know, a financial reporting problem that we think we can solve, what's the scale of the work that would be required. And then I would say, what are the disclosure considerations in this phase? Because I absolutely agree with the fundamental message of we can't just wait till, you know, disclosure at the end. And what we have to do is try and articulate as a framework, as kind of a memory jogger, what are the things we have to be thinking about with respect to disclosure in each phase. But this is, it should be a, what are the typical phases of a project, and then what are the disclosure considerations in each phase. To Gary's point, I think rather than saying our objective should be, let's say, for a major project, that at each paper decision you say, assuming that everything goes ahead as recommended by the staff, here's what we think it means for disclosure. I think there could be just a much simpler question that we structure into each. Maybe it would be wearisome to do it for every paper, but what are the disclosure implications of this package of recommendations? The answer sometimes might be too early to tell, or it might be if we don't recognize it, then we have to think about it as a disclosure, or because we're giving an option, we have, you know, have to think about alternatives. But just saying for each package of decisions or recommendations, explicitly asking the question, what are the disclosure implications of this? So that's in the paper side, but I'd say recast Appendix A. So it's here are the phases and objectives of a standard setting project. And you can incorporate things like, this is typically when we do outreach to X, kind, we should be trying to make sure we understand user needs. But some of those user needs may be met by recognition and measurement requirements, not just disclosure requirements. And I think this makes it sound like we're running a parallel universe only for disclosure. So integrate it, kind of overall steps, disclosure-specific considerations in this chart.
Yeah, if I could just respond briefly, because what I don't want to do is sort of promise something that we may well not deliver. Our objective as staff at the moment is to come up with a draft approach to improving the way we do things with disclosures to test. I don't think it's within our remit to start off this project to start saying we are coming up with, you know, the way the board will approach the whole of standard setting. So I'm just a bit cautious.
But if we can't articulate how we approach standard setting...
But isn't that the role of the due process handbook?
No. That's more the...
When you have to go for comment, it's more...
I found it very helpful when, several years ago, in connection with the run-up to the agenda consultation, we distilled an articulation of what the research phase was. And I think it's much more high level like that, because I think overall your message is, how do we integrate consideration of disclosure from the beginning rather than leaving it to the end? You know, what does that mean for the information gathering in the early days? What does it mean for the initial outreach? What does it mean for the preparation of an exposure draft, including cost-benefit considerations? Don't just leave it to the end. So what information do we have to get, what questions do we have to ask along the way, et cetera? And how do we think about it and accumulate that information as we go through it, rather than just stopping at the end and going back and saying, oh, if we've made all these decisions, then what disclosures do we need? But I understand your caution about saying, I don't want to solely be responsible for capturing the whole of our organization's operation. but I think it's just more a, you know, an overview and not too formal to Sue's concern about writing a parallel due process handbook, an overview and just saying, here's at each of these typical stages, here's what we have to think about for disclosure. It's not a, a separate universe only for disclosure considerations.
Sue? I share Catherine's caution because I think that sounds like terrible scope creep to me. While that's useful and interesting and why, of course, the whole drafting of disclosures, not so much for the targeted standards level review, but more generally, will need to fit in with a bigger project. I don't think we should be asking these guys to do that.
All right. Well, the staff has heard a lot to think about. Given that, can we ask the staff to continue working in this line?
No. 14?
14, whatever it may mean.
No.
13. Oh, 13, sorry. Okay. I got you. Yeah, 14.
All right. I think probably now is a good time to take a break. Short break. No?
I think possibly we prefer to have a break before materiality. It's okay with the board members.
Okay.
One more paper.
All right, if you promise to make it quick.
We have 15 minutes on the agenda, is that all right?
Got it, go ahead.
Okay, in that case, we'll move on to the selection of standards, which is agenda paper 11D.
So. All right. So agenda paper 11D is an educational paper, and it summarizes the staff's work so far relating to the topic of selecting the standards for purposes of the targeted review of disclosures. And we expect to ask the board to make a decision on which standards to select next month. In deciding which standards to select, the staff thinks it's important to keep in mind that the objectives of the board's review of disclosures are twofold. So the first objective is to improve the disclosure requirements in the selected standards so that users of financial statements are provided with information that is more useful. And the second objective is to test and improve the guidance for the board in developing and drafting disclosure requirements. Consequently, and mainly because of that second objective, the staff thinks that the selected standards should be representative of broader disclosure issues that have been identified as part of the principles of disclosure project. The staff considered three main sources of feedback in identifying the short list of standards, and those included the comment letters on the March 2017 discussion paper, feedback that we got from investor outreach activities specifically relating to that discussion paper, and meetings that we held with some consultative groups as well. Through that process, we identified a short list of 9 standards that we think the board should consider as potential candidates for the targeted standards level review of disclosures. And those shortlisted standards are listed in paragraph 9 of the paper. In table 1, we provide a high-level summary of the disclosure issues identified so far for each of the 9 shortlisted standards, and the remainder of the paper provides a more detailed summary for each standard. We think it is important to highlight that we have only included information that we have today in this table and the paper as a whole, or at least at the time the paper was being written. So the absence of a piece of feedback for a particular standard does not necessarily mean that the standard does not have a disclosure issue. Furthermore, whichever standard or standards that the board select will be subject to a detailed outreach program as part of our testing process later in the year. Finally, just to note that we have discussed this topic with our CMAC and GPF advisory groups at their joint meeting last week. We received lots of very useful feedback from that meeting, which we're still working through, and we expect to include this feedback, or we will include this feedback, in our July paper on this topic. So with that introduction, I'll now turn over to the board for discussion and any questions or suggestions for the staff in advance of making a decision on this topic next month.
Mary?
A couple things. One is you've identified in somewhere in this paper, paragraph 12, that there's one category which the issues relate to the disclosure objective, and then category B, some relate to disclosure requirements. I think we should make sure that the one, if we pick only one, or if we pick more, if we pick two, then one of them has issues related to the disclosure objective, because I think that's one of the things we really have to practice, how we get better at articulating the disclosure objective. A second thing is, I think we should be very, very cautious about picking a standard that is basically a disclosure-only standard, and or primarily about disclosure. And I think I put IS 7 in that category because it would be very hard for me to distinguish how we improve the disclosure requirements without reconsidering fundamentally the requirements for statement of cash flow. And if what we're trying to do is practice improving disclosures, I think we should avoid getting caught up in something that is very susceptible to scope creep. So that's a concern about that one. And I think it also has implications for segment, IFRS 8, again, fundamentally a disclosure standard. Something to think about with IFRS 2 as a candidate, maybe include in your analysis. I think many of the things that we hear about information users want about share-based payments is really information they want about equity instruments, and it just happens that share-based payment transactions are the source of many potentially dilutive equity instruments. And I think we have to think about whether the FICE project is going to be a more generic response to some of the the interest in equity instruments. It may be that IFRS 2 is a very good candidate, but it might be a better candidate after we are further along with FICE, and so we know what's going to be dealt with in terms of disclosure about equity instruments before we go back and say, if these are the disclosures that are prepared, provided for all equity instruments, what do we need to know about the share-based payment transaction in which those instruments were issued? So that might say it's a very good candidate, but it might benefit from after FICE is further along. So it may not be a good first candidate. And so those are just some reactions in terms of types of considerations and comments on a couple of specific standards.
Amara?
Thanks. So just a brief comment, not as detailed as Mary. Just a concern about the potential to include IFRS 13 in this exercise. And my concern is somewhat caution in the messaging, because we've just finished the PIR and we had some conclusions about the IFRS 13. It could be the case of, the frustration of some related to IFRS 13 because it's relatively new standard in terms of the PIR. So I think we should think about this aspect when deciding which standard to review.
Daryl,
can I disagree completely with Amara? So I think it's an important part of the messaging here. This is not like a PIR. This is a completely different exercise. What makes IFRS 13 useful is we've got a lot bigger body of very recent information available that we can access. I think it is important that we make it very clear that there is a distinction between what a PIR sets out to achieve, and the PIR of IFRS 13 has successfully achieved that. And what we're trying to do here, which is look at a different way of doing it using the information that we just happen to have got through the PIR process. So I'm not necessarily voting on particular ones, but I would be very cautious about eliminating 13 at this point.
Different subject, income taxes. I think there's an opportunity for making a significant improvement actually to the income taxes disclosures if we take that one on. The feedback we got during the research project is that users are dissatisfied with the disclosures. They're poorly presented. There's not enough disaggregation, and then and the information not given in a way that's useful. So, for example, the tax reconciliation I think ought to be a really important piece of information, but it needs to be granular enough that people can actually see what the reconciling items are, and to see what different tax rates are being applied in different geographical areas, for example. The deferred tax information is very poorly presented. I think the preparers don't really understand what it's trying to convey. The users don't understand what it's trying to convey because it's poorly presented, and so the users end up ignoring it totally. And so I think actually trying to recast those disclosures in a way that explains more clearly what the information is, what the objectives are, how users can use that not only to assess what happened in the past, but also how they can try and feed that into the projection for the future. I think that would be a really valuable exercise, and I think we can make a big difference there if we took that one on.
And Swaz?
Well, I wanted to bring a few comments. First of all, on IFRS 13, I may be mistaken in my understanding, but I thought we had closed the post-implementation review by having identified that there might be some improvements to be made to disclosures and made the decision, as is reflected in the paper, that we would deal with that as a good candidate, so that to me it was already identified as... Yeah. So that's the first point. The second is a comment that I made several times already. To me, we should try as much as feasible. I mean, and I would say, to the extent that the projects which are open today provide a good basis to test what we want to test. So, to the extent that it is done, I think we should prioritize the projects which are already open, so those that we are working on, so that we are not, in fact, because of this project making a different assessment on priorities on standard setting that we've made out of the last agenda consultation. And another, maybe we will come to the conclusion that there is in the list one or the other standard that would be such a good opportunity to test the guidance altogether that it would be worthwhile to elect it. But I would have, if we do that, I would have a serious word of caution, because we are going to want to do something that is very rational, having, you know, as you've described in the former paper, we will want to relate to what kind of assessments users would want to make and the like. Our previous discussion has shown how interrelated things are between measurement and recognition requirements and disclosures. And if we embark in a project where we could see more rational outcomes, restarting with the users, the needs of primary users, would highlight eventually deficiencies, or I wouldn't say deficiencies, but things that could be improved in measurement and requirement, we are going to be in a score creep circumstance. And either we're not going to achieve what we would want to achieve in disclosures, or we're going to be in a very uncomfortable situation. So that would be my word of caution.
Daryl, again?
So perhaps building quite a lot on what Francois just said, I think we need to bear in mind as we go into this process that scope creep is going to be something that can happen very easily. And if we're looking at a standard that essentially feels like it's a standard that needs a very significant revamping, I think it's going to very quickly end up as being part of the debate there. So I think that's one point of caution. I think the other point of caution that's worth bearing in mind again is what the objective of the exercise is. So we could be going into this with two ways of thinking about it. The one is, let's pick the standards that are the most broken in terms of disclosure with a view to trying to fix the disclosure. Alternatively, what we could be going in here is saying, we have a process. We want to test how this process works. And is there a better way of doing disclosures that might make people work with the disclosure requirements? Now, my concern, and it's to Peter's comments really about IS-12, my problem is I'm not sure what we would conclude if we did IS-12 through this process. Because it feels to me like we won't be learning lessons that we could easily apply to other standards. Now, I might be wrong in that, but I just think in the context of the conversations you have with others, I think that I don't think we should be making it about the standard that most needs to be fixed. We should rather be making about it the standard that we can most learn from.
I'd like to talk about IFRS 8. I think next meeting, when we actually decide, I think IFRS 8 is going to come up then. And one of the reasons is we had very strong feedback from our consultative groups. So the CMAC group, out of their group, eight people chose number one, IFRS 8. So that's a message to us that they think there's something wrong with the disclosures. We might decide IFRS 8 is not the right candidate for what we're trying to do, thinking about our objectives in this work, but we have a significant group of stakeholders who think there's something wrong with the disclosures in IFRS 8. And if we're going to decide that it's not an appropriate standard for this review, which we may well decide for very good reasons, I think we still have to know what our response to our stakeholders is when they have brought it up again. And this isn't the first time they've brought up IFRS 8. They brought it up last week, we heard, but we've also heard it in other projects, and it comes up when staff are consulting, and it came up in Goodwill, and we rightly said it was out of scope, and it came up in, obviously, the post-implementation review, but it didn't lead to us taking action on disclosures, and it came up in the agenda consultation, and we don't have any way that we're flagging that we are going back. So I'm just concerned about a sense of frustration that our users might have, that they're sending us a message and we're not acting on the message they're sending us.
But it would be doubly frustrating if we'd gone through an exercise which will, again, not lead to change.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yes. Yes.
So better not touch it, I would say. Martin?
Yeah, I'm a little bit confused because, man, what is the primary objective of why we are doing that? Is it to improve disclosure in a standard or to test the process? And my thought was, okay, we should test the process with that. But what I'm hearing, okay, that we're picking based on which standard is broken and we need better disclosure. I think that is not an objective of that. And therefore, I think the staff should pick a standard where you think, okay, it best demonstrate, okay, how we can show if the new process will work or not. And we should not have a debate, okay, that after a PIR, is that broken or not? Because I think that is not the purpose of this exercise.
But in itself, it would perhaps make sense to test the new approach on a broken standard to see, well, you know, if we in the future use these principles or this approach, then we probably have a better success,
But pick IFRS 8. I mean, if we would conclude, okay, that we should have sent segment information not by management, by IFRS, then people would say big success. Yeah. But would that come to the conclusion the process is now better? No, I think that is also the problem if we take a broken standard, because if we do some improvement, everybody thinks the process is working. But maybe it was not the process because the standard was previously so weak that it was not even difficult to change it to better.
If I could just add one thing, which is the objectives are, of course, twofold. One thing that is very important in our minds is that in order to test the process that we are developing at the moment, something that is absolutely key is the opportunity to understand investor needs and get their engagement. So we would prefer to pick a standard where there is, you know, room for improvement, because we think that will be, that will give us more to work with in terms of testing what we're trying to do.
Sue?
Probably means, depends what we mean by broken, doesn't it? So I think we need to be, I'd need a lot of convincing that on something like IFRS 8, well, I know there is a lot of investor frustration, that by drafting the disclosure requirements better, we were actually going to provide some satisfaction. So I think for me, the type of broken that we should be looking for is where we think that the way that the drafting is done might be contributing to the problem outcome. So, for example, we're getting the wrong level of disaggregation, or it's clear that the way that the disclosures are being provided is not meeting whatever the objective was. So that's why I think personally, to show my hand a little bit, IFRS 13 might be quite a good candidate, because I think it would enable us to test how we better express disaggregation, which seems to be one of the issues we've got, and maybe it helps us test a better articulation of what the objective of the disclosures is, because there seems to be a bit of a sense that it's a bit of a checklist approach at the moment. And also I think the other reason why it might be quite a good test is one of the points that came up in some of the discussions yesterday is I think we've got quite a disconnect between what preparers might think is relevant slash useful versus what users need. I'm thinking of the level 3 disclosures. So it might be a good test of a situation where we need to be able to draft something that makes it very clear that we think this is a disclosure that typically should be provided, but without using the shall word, and writing it in a more objective based way where there's quite a disconnect between what preparers might want and what users might hope for. And so I think it's quite a good drafting broken example. It's not really that we're changing the nature of the information we're asking for, it's the way that we write it that we think might get a better outcome. I think that's the sort of standard that we're looking for.
Jen Chao.
Thank you, Hans. I agree with Francois and Daryl's point. I think when we choose the standards, I think we should think about whether it is worthwhile to do so. And also, I agree with Martin that we also, in the meantime, we should test our process. So I think both objectives could be achieved. So I'm thinking what kind of approach or methodology we could have to achieve that objective. I'm thinking we should select one or two standards. I would suggest two standards. One standard, that standard already contains the objective there, such as IFRS 13, as Sue mentioned, and we can test whether those disclosure requirements and meet the objective, whether any improvements it could have. One is old IS standards. Those IS standards have no objective there, and there are some implementation issues come out, as Peter mentioned. So we can test if we add the objective, disclose objective, and then, you know, illustrate the detailed disclosure requirement, whether can improve and meet the user's needs. So I would suggest that we pick one, and one is IFRS standard, which already contain, you know, disclosure objective. One is not yet.
Chit-chat, your microphone is off.
No.
It really seems it's
not where
it's. Okay, yeah. Right, sorry.
Doc?
Thank you. Just the incremental point we need to consider is efficiency of the board and staff. Of course, to find out what is the most suitable standard is really important, but not only that, we have to consider the efficiency or timeliness of the standard. So I would suggest that, that there are some standards which already have made a research, like IFRS 13. I wonder if it is not suitable or not IFRS 8, but maybe IFRS 13 is better. And one more is IFRS 3. We need to visit the disclosure about IFRS 3 anyway. So considering the efficiency is also the important issue staff have to consider.
Nick?
Thank you. I agree with Martin that our primary objective here is to test the process. That's what we really want to do, and I think that does require an element of care when we select the standard. We have to recognise there are user frustrations about segment reporting, but the danger of using IFRS 8, it would blow up the process. I mean, actually, we wouldn't end up with anything through that. Equally, I'm cautious about selecting what I regard as a standard where you only get specialists engaging. And so in that respect, IFRS 13, I'm not sure either is the ideal candidate. I think it's a subset of users that would focus on that standard. So I would look elsewhere.
But Francoise made a good point. Haven't we already decided to take
it? We haven't decided. We said it would be an option.
Oh.
We said we didn't. We said it would be one we would consider rather than decide, rather than commit, I believe. Is that?
Yeah, and can I just comment on IFRS 13 as well? I think an important part of that is that if you decide not to take it on as in the standards level review, I think the board ought to make an explicit decision whether to drop it or whether to carry on in some other way, so it doesn't just get forgotten completely.
To me, it was decided already.
I thought it was an option to be considered. Perhaps a better way of phrasing it, if it shouldn't be the sole one. Perhaps if we take two, it could be one, but certainly not the sole one.
Yeah, I think that would to not take just one standard would be good anyway, I think.
Yeah. Choose two slightly different ones.
Amaru?
Thanks, I'll just refer to how I read this paper and the origin of my comment. Paragraph 6A, the staff is very clear that the objective of the review is to improve the disclosure and requirement in the selected standard. So we are talking differently here. Some I do understand the objective is just to explore the guidance, and this is not what's in the paper. And that's why my reaction to IFRS 13. I didn't say we shouldn't do. I just cautioned that we just finalized PIR, and the staff is saying that the objective is to really change what's, if necessary, the standard. So if this is the objective, I think we should be very careful in choosing the standard. I don't think this was the objective at inception, or this was the objective in Agenda Paper 11C, but the reading of the whole paper, in my case, was driven by this paragraph. And if this paragraph is not the correct reflection of our decision, then the discussion is totally distinct. I think what we proposed in 11C was 6B only, and not 6A.
Mary?
Building on that, I put my flag up partly to say, I think we should say the objective is 6B. And then I think 6A should become kind of a sanity test on will it be worth it, or are we, you know, practicing on something that will not deliver any benefits. But I have concerns certainly about making it the first objective, and even about making it an equal six. Sorry, it being 6A, an equal objective. I think it's subsidiary that we should get some specific benefits, but I don't think that should be an objective of the project. I think the objective should be to test. The other thing is, this goes to a comment made by Francoise and then a related one by Tak. Francoise reminded us to focus on what our standard-setting priorities are already. Where have we decided that there's the highest overall need? And I think that those are the ones where we have already done some work or are planning some work. And that gets to Tak's point about efficiency, that before we can think about disclosure and practice, you know, whatever the process, the discipline is, we have to gear our minds up in terms of reminding what the issues are, what the concerns are, et cetera. If we can leverage something either that we've already done or that we are planning to, you know, to do, and I think that that means that I'd need a very strong reason for why to go to something that we haven't been looking at recently or are planning to do, let's say, in the research pipeline, you know, as a warm-up, because that way we'll get more leverage of the investment in thinking about the requirements and standard.
Yeah, I mean, if I could just try and clarify something. On 6A and B, I think it's a very fair point you raise, and certainly with retrospect we might have put those in the other order. We do see B as being absolutely fundamental. The one thing that I will say about A is that in order to really achieve something with this testing process, I think it is also important that we pick a standard where there is room for improvement, because if we don't, the value of the testing and what we learn will be limited.
Right. So that's why I say I think our objective is 6B, but we should say then, if we've got a list of candidates, do we think we'd also get some benefits at looking at the standard alone? So it's kind of a secondary sanity test rather than an objective.
That we have to decide later.
Yeah.
But I think we need to...
Yeah.
I think we do need to be very careful with what our objective is, because I thought I knew what we were focusing on until I've listened to the discussion, because I think some of us, I don't even know which camp I'm in anymore, some of us are thinking that really what we're doing is saying, okay, we sort of have a set of disclosure requirements in a standard, we sort of know what the disclosure requirements are, and what we're focusing on is better articulating them so that what we've already asked for is delivered in a way that's more relevant and useful, better taking into account materiality, disaggregation, that type of stuff. But basically, this is the set of requirements. Whereas I think some are saying we're going to sort of do that. But in addition, we're going to think about whether there's some stuff we can delete from the requirements and some stuff we might need to add. And I think Amaro's reaction is, if it's the latter, is that going to freak people out when we've just looked at something like IFRS 13 and we've been talking more about the first bit of it, the clarity and the outcome? So how broad do we really mean?
Just in response to that and to clarify, the decision that we made in March was framed and has been sort of communicated externally as improving disclosure requirements, changes to the volume of requirements in either direction could be a consequence, but it's not an objective. We've stated that explicitly throughout everything we've decided to do.
But I think you can hear that in two different ways.
Yeah.
Françoise.
2 points. I mean, I'm concerned if I would be very concerned if objective I6I would disappear, because I don't think we should make any standard setting effort that doesn't have as a possible outcome an improvement to the quality of financial reporting. So to me, I is a necessary objective. Let's not touch, in other words, let's not touch a standard just for without having, as a result, a benefit in financial reporting. So I fully agree that B is fundamental. Otherwise, we're not going to achieve the main objective. But I is, in my view, necessary also in the way we select the standards. The second point I wanted to make is to, follow up on the various comments that have been made around IFRS 8. I also agree that IFRS 8, given where we are, what we've learned, what we have tested, and all, would not be a good candidate to constrain into this exercise. Now, I would also be sympathetic to, at the point, and I don't know in what way, but we consider whether there is something that could be done to respond to the call that we keep receiving from users.
But I'm not sure it's that black and white, and that's the challenge, because I think arguably if we've got some standards that are written in a way that it's that people are reading it and applying it as an absolute black and white checklist, where they're not, they feel they can't step back and assess what really is helpful for users and the way to present it in a way that provides the best information. Arguably, if we have that situation and we re-articulate the disclosure requirements in a way that's more objective-based and less of a checklist, you could still get improvements to financial reporting, even though that's a narrower scope than a more fundamental review. I think that's where I'm getting confused.
Martin?
And I'm now even more confused what we're doing. I thought we're doing, develop a kind, picking a standard, looking at our processes which we have developed, testing it, okay, if that would be improved disclosure, which means, okay, we going through the standard, making changes, and then I think we trying to get inputs and from investors, from preparers, is it more useful, is it a better kind of disclosure? If we're doing in parallel, changing a standard, I don't know what the process is, do we then have an exposure draft? As usually when we do changing a standard and then having said effective, and then the test is, then the standard is live, and then maybe in a post-invitation review we get feedback, okay, was it better or not? I thought we looking for the first and not the second one. But if we're doing that in parallel, I'm totally confused, because then I'm totally against this testing. should not do that.
Just to clarify exactly what was decided in March in terms of testing, the intention is that when the board has finished making decisions about guidance and has picked one or two standards, we would then apply the guidance to those standards. That's what we call what we're referring to as testing, doing outreach to understand user needs, to get to objectives, etc. We would then be looking to develop that into an exposure draft of proposed changes with a basis for conclusions that explains how those proposed changes were arrived at, so that we can get feedback from all stakeholders about both aspects, and whether that exposure draft ultimately ended up as a final standard would be dependent upon that.
Okay. Was it is in March?
If that, you know, then I don't understand why
it's not tested.
IFRS 8 could be on this list when we have just concluded we're not going to touch it.
Because we felt it was important to develop the list on a completely objective basis, i.e. which standards have we had feedback about. This paper, that's not to say IFRS 8 is going to be the best candidate, but we can't. We thought it was appropriate to have a list that reflected all the feedback we've had so the board can decide between those standards. That's not to say they're all great choices for other reasons.
But do I now understand that some of the board are hesitant to do this exercise and have it result in a standard change?
Yeah, I am.
You are very hesitant about, but that's what we decided before,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, okay, so we're still there. Okay. All right.
So, and clarification. Yeah, if we, what have you just said is right, I have no question. Because based on this 10-point plan, on your original plan, so if you see the 9 is a kind of developing the kind of disclosure framework or standard. The last item is review all existing standards. So that the last step is, as what Hans said, we are going to amend some, you know, disclosure requirements in existing standard. That's right.
I mean, that 10-point plan is back from the early days of the disclosure initiative.
Right.
What we are doing now is responsive to a lot of feedback we've had since then. So you know, that there are similarities.
So because we assume that we are going to amend some disclosure requirements in existing standards, that's why we have decided to the IFRS 8 and the IFRS 13. We didn't do anything after PIR, so we put everything here in a amending those disclosure requirements, as one just summarized there. So even there is some confusion, however, this kind of testing our process of some kind of is one purpose, but still we need to finish the item 10 of this 10-point plan.
So what, to help try and help Catherine here, so what we've agreed to do is to choose one or two standards next month that we're going to try and look at the disclosures,
sure,
and propose some amendments and test them through our normal consultation process, yes, which would involve an exposure draft. So that's what we've agreed to do.
Yes.
I think the only debate for me is around what type of standard are we trying to choose and what sort of testing are we,
yeah,
like, yes, how far are we going? That for me is my only area of uncertainty. I completely knew we were heading to exposure draft territory.
Tom? And then we don't need to vote, so that's a relief.
No vote.
I'd say we don't need to vote, so that's a relief.
We'll be clear next month.
Just on the 6A and B, coming back and whether we should exclude things or not, if we really want to work on developing and improving a process that we're going to be able to use repeatedly, I would, you know, say that, okay, so now I would put them in a sequential order, 6B first. I might be inclined to leave all standards on the table. In other words, I want to test it on the one that will help us build the best process. And if at the end of the day we don't want to touch it because we said we're not touching number 8, then fine. But I'm just saying, what should be the priority? And I think,
well,
my priority.
We do B by doing A, no?
No, that's the. I just.
I think the other way around. Hopefully, we do A by
doing B.
Yeah.
So at the end,
yeah,
once we've done this,
oh, okay,
if we perfect the process, we can decide to leave the standard alone or not. But the idea, I think, was that we're going to sort of iterate over time in this process and really improve the process. If that's the prime thing, I think we should choose the standard that will help us build. And I'm assuming, and I'll throw something in I maybe should have thrown in earlier, that when we're doing the 5 steps, that part of this process will be fleshing out those steps and giving us advice on how to reach out and how to structure our reach out so that we get the information we know to improve the disclosure. So I think I'm not sure that, I think there may be some sequencing here, and if I had a choice, I'd try and build the process and the best I can. And to me, if we fix a standard early, that's a bonus. If we decide we have to wait till we've tested it further, I'm okay.
Another one of the things that would help us for the paper that you bring back, because I think Tom's point's a good one, is are we trying to choose a standard that best tests the whole process, like how we talk to investors, how we deal with the feedback, that whole step 1 to 5 thing that we were talking about earlier on, or are we trying to find the standard that best enables us to test how to write the actual words well? Because I think they're two slightly different tests.
Okay.
What do you test? Process or is it standard?
Both. Stuff, Mullen.
Both.
It's always a joint test.
Joint test, right, yeah.
Okay, I think we're ready for a coffee break.
Yeah.
11:20.
Okay then, so our final paper for this morning asks you to re-deliberate the definition of materials. So to tee that one up, up to Siobhan.
Okay, so I will be summarising agenda paper 11E, and I will pause for discussion at each question for the board to discuss. So the first section of the paper is about including the concept of obscuring information in the definition of material. This is the element of the proposals that received the most feedback from respondents. While staff did consider several options for achieving equal prominence of omitting, misstating, and obscuring, we will only summarise the staff recommendation today. So the staff recommend that the board retains the amendment to elevate the concept of obscuring into the definition of material. This is because we believe that including this concept will address concerns that obscuring material information has a similar effect to omitting or misstating that information, and as a result, should be of equal prominence. For the reasons described in paragraphs 28 to 30 of the paper, we also think the inclusion of obscuring does not alter the underlying concept of materiality. Instead, we think the practical impact of the proposal is that the concept of obscuring information will need to be given greater weight when entities are deciding how to communicate material information. Finally, in light of feedback received about the explanation of obscuring that was proposed in the exposure draft, we recommend replacing the proposed wording with an explanation that information is obscured if it is communicated in a way that has a similar effect for primary users of financial statements to omitting or misstating that information. In addition, we recommend that this explanation be accompanied by a list of examples which detail circumstances where material information may be obscured. So the first question for the board is, does the board agree with the staff recommendations that the board should retain the proposal to include the concept of obscuring in the bold definition of material and replace the proposed wording explaining the concept in the explanatory paragraphs with a clearer description and examples? And I'll hand over to the board. Thank you.
Oswald.
Thank you for this. And I think I agree with your recommendation, especially little I in your question box. I also agree to B, but to a certain extent. So when I look at paragraph 37, I think you have come with, in my view, very good description of how information can be obscured when we move from A to E. The little bit that I have a problem, in fact, I think I have a problem of understanding it. So to me, I don't think I would need anything more than A to E, is when you state, we would, in fact, to explain, we would say that information is obscured if it is communicated in a way that it has a similar effect for primary users to omitting or mistaking. So when I read this sentence, it's as if I was reading that obscuring is a subset of omitting and misstating. And if that was the case, then we would not need to make the change to add obscuring and bring it to as prominent a way as omitting and misstating are already present in the definition. So I think what we need is bringing obscuring in addition to omitting and misstating and explaining how information can be obscured. And I think that from 37A and E, you do that very well.
So did you say B or E? I'm sorry.
A through E.
A through E.
I agree with the staff's recommendations. I was puzzled by some of the feedback that we'd had, so I went back and had a look at all of the comments on the topic of obscuring, and I think that what you've proposed here, for me, seemed to address the main concerns that I saw raised, because a lot of it was around, I think, wanting more explanation about what the concept of obscuring meant, which you're doing through your proposal. And also I wasn't... I agree with, I think, one of the observations that you make. I don't think we're really changing the population as a result of adding the word obscuring, but we are helping remind people that it matters. So I think you achieve that, so that's helpful. In terms of Françoise's comment, that's an interesting comment. But I don't think I share the concern, because the way that I tried to think about it myself when I was thinking about, was it okay or not, or was it a good thing to put obscuring in the definition, the way that I tested it myself was thinking of extreme examples of obscuring, because I think that's sort of what we're getting at. So we're sort of saying, have you presented the information in such a way that it may as well not even be there? And I think by reinforcing that idea here, you'll give people, I hope, comfort that we're not talking about these subtle, fine edge things that they were worried about. We're talking about really the more extreme cases where, sure, it's there, but it's done in such a way that it may as well not be there. And that's what we're talking about. So I don't see it as a subset. It's rather a way of thinking about how severe we mean it needs to be, which I think will address some of the concerns about the subjectivity at the edges. So I really like what you propose.
Martin?
Yeah, I'm struggling a little bit with 37E, where we say, okay, it is material information being hidden or clouded by immaterial information. And I think we have decided or think, okay, it should be only disclosed material information. Immaterial information don't have a big place. And does that then fit to the overall concept? Because I mean, if we're explaining that, but usually we think, okay, immaterial information shouldn't be in the notes or in the financial statements, why we are explaining that. And even if a repairer maybe has, and is it always a judgment, what is material, immaterial, but how to assess it? Because I think, okay, if a regulator has to judge that, okay, was that hidden by immaterial information, I think is very, very difficult and judgmental. And therefore, I think, really, do we need that E? When I'm overall with the concept, I'm fine, clear, but do we have to add it in the definition of material and then adding this special sentence or this paragraph? I'm really struggling with that, because I'm seeing, okay, if something, because usually you have the concept everything is material, so we should put only material information, but then something is judging you and saying, okay, it is obscured because it is not placed so prominent as I personally would expect it. Have it placed, and then to judge that, was that a material misstatement, or I don't know. I think that is a difficult concept for me.
That's 37E like Edward, you're questioning?
E.
E like Edward, okay.
Could I add one comment in case it's helpful? On 37E, I think you make a very fair challenge, because it is a real a judgment call and it is difficult. The reason why we were comfortable with that and comfortable with that as a almost a one sentence without further explanation is because it's actually very similar to IS 130A, which says at the moment entities shall not reduce understandability by obscuring material information with immaterial information.
But that is where I'm struggling with, because when I think as a preparer, I would say, okay, the guidance from the following ISB discussion is you should only disclose material stuff. Immaterial, you don't have to disclose. So you have only in the notes material. How can something be obscured by immaterial information if by the first hand you only disclose material information? And if we give that as guidance as an ISB, I'm really struggling with that. Because I think our guidance is we should not have immaterial information.
I don't think we actually say that, do we?
That is my understanding.
Certainly we want people or require people to disclose what's material.
Exactly.
And we try to discourage them from putting in immaterial stuff, but it's sort of done indirectly in the way that's reflected.
But that is my point, Sue. But as a preparer, I would prepare my financial statements only to disclose material information. So my judgment is this material information. And why can I then obscure something which maybe other people think it is immaterial or not material? I don't know. I'm struggling with this concept.
In materiality practice statement, we specifically discussed a situation in which a local regulator may require you to disclose something that is not material from an IFRS standards perspective, and we explained that that disclosure is not prohibited by IFRS standards, even though it is immaterial, but that you have to think about how you present it. So I think we're trying to walk that fine line of not prohibiting immaterial, but not, you know, certainly discouraging it, but not prohibiting it.
But the consequence is, if you put something we're using in the wrong place because people think it is not prominent in us, then the consequence is, my understanding is, okay, that it is a material error because it is in the definition of material, and then you have to restate. And that is, I'm really have problems with, because that is so judgmental that people think, okay, maybe you should have put on the in the first note, maybe you have done it in the note number 35, and maybe not in the first place, maybe in the second. I don't know how to do it.
Even though the staff are trying to address that by pointing out that what we mean is things that are so obscured that you might as well have left it out of the financial statements.
I have to decide today. Do I judge? And I really, I'm like this concept, would include it, but if we make it close to this kind hidden by immaterial, I don't know. I'm not fine with that, because I think that is then the consequence are that regulators and auditors can say, okay, I think it is not material, and you have put it in between two immaterial information, and therefore you have to restate your financial statement, because also in the definition of material, it must be material error. That is how I see it. I see it when A, B, C, and D, I'm fine with it. Inappropriate disaggregation, aggregations, this kind of things I like, but others I'm really struggling with that. That is my point.
Gary?
Thank you. I agree with the staff recommendation on including obscuring, and actually have changed my views on that. I mean, one time I didn't think it was necessary, and then I said, well, if we do it, I have worries similar to what Martin is saying about how would it get applied by regulators, enforcers, or auditors, and I get some concerns on that. But I think I'll go through what they are quickly, but I think they can probably be handled in the basis. I think you got it exactly right, saying it's got the same effect as being omitted or missing. I think that's got to be the right frame of reference to it. And such that you're actually, as Sue pointed out, you're better off without it, or you wouldn't know. You'd be better off without it. Let's leave it at that. I think as I go through 37A through E, I'll just give some general comments that apply kind of broadly to them all. And again, I think we can. I think it's important to be done in the basis and thought process. I'll begin with. I think we need to understand that our definition of primary user is defined as including people who have reasonable knowledge of business and economics, a willingness to study diligently the information, recognizing on occasion they may need to retain specialists in financial accounting to help them. So with that said, is you'll see a lot of external reporting is written heavily in industry jargon. Is that obscuring because it's not in plain English or plain language? I think you can have that argument. So I think we, likewise, a lot of external disclosures, the lawyers have got a very heavy hand, and it's written more like lawyer to lawyer, but it's still accurate. It's clear if you understand it and so on. Again, I think we need to start dealing with some of this stuff in the basis such that this is not about writing style. It's about writing things such that you can't, someone who's reasonably knowledgeable, cannot get the point that you're making. Under 37A is vague and unclear. It really is to whom. If it's written in heavy industry jargon, most of your primary users, industry specialists, it is clear to them. It might not be clear to somebody else. So again, these are all, I think, what do we really mean can be dealt in the basis. because it's got, if the goal is the effect of omitting or misstating, okay. In terms of, I think you also don't want to get into debates as a result of the words we pick about the flow or the order of footnotes in there. Not every item can fit on the first page. I mean, you get 100 pages of footnotes, some things can be on the last page, but presumably it's important to be in the document. And somebody at one of my breakout sessions last week said, says the easiest place to hide a tree is in a forest, so you kind of got to deal with this is the buried facts doctrine comes into play in here as well. And I think we're talking about, you don't obscure something like putting up that should be up front or prominent way in the back behind a bunch of superfluous stuff. And I could go on and on about that, but I'm trying to make the point. The other thing I think we got to say is that judgment is required in all this. I think that needs to be emphasized in the beginning, the middle, and the end of discussion on these things, because what's clear to one person might not be clear to another, and vice versa. The idea is to have effective communication. In the IAS 1 change a couple years ago, and I think it's a material I practiced, we made it really clear, we cannot prohibit immaterial information from being disclosed. Just don't put so much of it in there that obscures it. Then it gets to be a question of the degree. There's always going to be some immaterial information disclosed, either because it completes the storyboard, it's sort of customary that it's there, and so on. But you don't want so much of it in there deliberately, such that you miss it. It's the inappropriate disaggregation point. So those are my suggestions for what to include the basis and the so on.
Amaru.
Thanks, Sis. That's just a very quick point on that. I do agree with staff's proposal. I think it's a quite significant enhancement to the concept we have today. And I think you responded quite well to the feedback in terms of clarification. On Martin's point, I think he has a very reasonable way of expressing what in principle should be our standard. So if something that we do not expect to see disclosed as relevant information, we shouldn't really even mention. However, in practice, that's not the reality. So I think it's extremely important to have all these reasoning in the base for conclusion, and why is that? To explain very clearly why we are making reference to irrelevant information.
Mary?
Support the staff's proposal, thinking about the concern Martin expressed with E, Gary's suggestion about basis. I think it would be very helpful to say something along the following lines in the basis, that in our redeliberations we added the discussion in paragraph 37, you know, A through E, because we were trying to give context to this requirement that we are not creating a requirement to optimize the presentation, but rather to avoid, as Sue said, the extreme situation where it's the same effect as omitting. And we thought that, you know, based on the feedback we got on the ED, we thought it would be helpful to provide a bit more. But I think that's the kind of thing Gary was also talking about, explaining in the basis that it's not you have to find the best presentation, but you have to not do the extreme of it's equivalent to omitting it. And then that, I think, gives context for the what's in A3 of 37.
Yeah, can I just build on that, Mary? I think the concern would be is you write something that most people would view as clear, you know, when we're comprehensive and on point. And yet an enforcer says, I write better than you do. You didn't write it my way, therefore you fail the obscuring test. I mean, that's what we're trying to avoid. And again, I think we just say that directly.
And John?
I think, yes. First of all, I support staff's proposal, especially when I read the paragraphs 37, once we add the explanation and the examples. Actually, I also changed mine. I agree with staff's proposal to include the obstacle information in the definition. With regard to Martin's concern about paragraph 37E, I'm thinking that whether the wording could be changed to more neutral. It seems that, you know, the material information being hiding or clouded by, you know, hiding sometimes it's not neutral, yeah. So can change those material information being mixed with, you know, in material information, something like that, using some kind of neutral wording to illustrate these cases maybe better, yeah. And I want to just confirm Francois's concern about the wording with regard to the paragraph, I think, 38 and 34. 38 and 40, both paragraphs mentioned. I think first I agree with staff that obstacling, omitting, and misstating should be of equal prominence. But the reason is you show that we try to communicate in a way that they have similar effect, you know, to the primary users. The information was missing, the information was obstacle, maybe different. So the effect may be different. So how to illustrate those reasons, I'm a little bit cautious about whether they really could have similar effect to those, you know, users, because the information actually may be different, maybe some information more important than others. So, yeah.
Tom?
First, can I get a clarification and then I have a comment? So just to be clear, when we're looking at, say, paragraph 37, A through E, this is kind of a little bit like the wording. It's not the definitive wording you would go to at this point.
Well, we still have the drafting process to go through,
yeah.
So that's the kind of thing we've got in mind.
But it's the general view. Okay, and the other part is this is still clarification. We're talking about, with a clear description and examples. So is 37A through E the description?
No, 37 A through E would be what we would use as the examples.
Okay, because that was where I was. To me, an example is you say company A did blah, blah, blah. Here's their paragraph. Here's why it's awful. To me, as an example, what's in 37 are descriptions of types of obscuring. It's not obvious. And if you go there, do you actually want sort of what I would call Tom's types of examples, if you couldn't call those? So I just kind of urge you to think about how much detailed example and how much is description. By the way, I'm in favor of going here. I just want us to make sure we get here in the right way. And now here's my comment. So that was my clarification, which I guess included a comment. On the E, yesterday when we were talking with the FASB, they talked about the standard, you know, there was a lot of worry about disclosures where people wouldn't apply materiality and use their judgment not to disclose something that the standard could require. And there was the idea generally that the materiality trumps requirements when the stuff's immaterial. The reason it's in the standard is because it's relevant. And even Amaro, sometimes we're using immateriality and not relevant as synonyms. But I think they're not exactly the same. So if a standard says this disclosure is relevant, and then you use materiality and say in our specific situation it's immaterial, I just really, when we always use immaterial, and even in 30, I know it's in 30A, it because the material immaterial is such a tenuous line, because by the definition in a standard, some of the immaterial is relevant, right? And I always wonder whether, again, wording irrelevant would almost be is what, in fact, I find obscures is people just put in a pile of junk that it's not even a judgment call that the standard requires it. They're just pouring crap into the thing. So, again, I'm not quite sure what to do with this, but I really, having listened yesterday, that because material immaterial is very much a judgment call or can be on what is generally considered relevant, that's a pretty tough line to put into something about when you're obscuring. That's my comment.
Tech?
Thank you. Let me put it a slightly different way. If you look at paragraph 29, I think there are good literature. It says in the second line, decision could be influenced by the absence of a piece of information irrespective of the cause of the absence. So the question is whether or not the information was absent. Of course, there is a case, information is there, but it is clouded by the immaterial information. So as an outcome, users cannot reach that information in the proper effort. So if it was not given the proper prominence, then most users may overlook. And the problem is, if that was done accidentally or unintentionally, that is okay. But there are many preparers who do it intentionally to cover up the information. And then they could argue, we have disclosed it, you just overlooked it. So that is the fine line. And it's up to the regulator, how to judge it. But our standard is kind of principle basis. It's like a kind of gentleman's rule. So we have to put it, this type of word of securing is necessary. As a gentleman, if you think it's really material, you have to give the proper prominence so that the user can easily reach. So that is the whole point.
So we need to say you should do your disclosures like a gentleman. Nick?
Thank you. I support the staff recommendation. On paragraph 37, I actually didn't read obscuring as a subset. I read it as a long... So that was my interpretation. I read it alongside omitting and misstating. Looking through A to E, and on E in particular, I guess, which is where the controversy is, I'm a little bit reluctant about using the word mixed. I think mixed could sound like alongside. I'm not really sure that's what we're saying. I think hidden or clouded is different from mixed, so I would retain the words that you have.
Martin, can you tell us you've been convinced?
No, maybe a little bit better explain my point, because if you have to prepare, let's assume, financial statements of a big financial institution, like HSBC or others. And people saying, okay, these are 400 pages up to 500 pages. People don't understand it because so many information. What I think is, okay, what you try as a preparer of this kind of financial statements for a financial institution include only material information. But you can, with a 400, 500-page document, always make the point, okay, that is, this information is obscured. Mm-hmm. So all kind of material information is obscured in this kind of document. Mm-hmm. And that is, like, we make it now, bring it into the materiality definition. I think that is a big starting point then for any regulators to say, if something goes wrong, and it is often the case that something is okay with hindsight, you say, okay, that was really material. And then you're picking not only was that information included in the financial statement, was it prominent enough and not obscured? And that is a very, very difficult judgment. And I, as a preparer, could not, if I have to do a 400-page kind of document, which I think all information is material, to say, okay, is it now obscured or not? Clearly some is obscured with that. And clearly it is a judgment call, how material is that information? And with hindsight, that is so difficult to do. And that is why I'm really absolutely against this point E, because that is a kind of think, okay, how really should you do it?
Hans, I explained with a 400-page document. I think all information are obscured in that, because that is a kind of where do you start, do you stop to read?
That was their daily job, wasn't it?
That was my daily job. And therefore, I think always happy that I had. After, with hindsight, people said, okay, that wasn't important. I could pick, yeah, but it was in note number 53. There was okay explanation.
And only after 10 years,
was it so prominent?
Maybe not. In the markets about the real situation.
Was it prominent or not? And that, I think, is a difficult thing, a judgment call. And therefore, I think, but with this, including that in the definition, you always come to the conclusion that it is then material mistake and you have to restate your financial statements. And that is, I think, is so judgmental that, okay, the consequences are too high for that. It is my reasoning also. Maybe you don't able to explain it better, but I think that is why I'm struggling with it.
I mean, if I could respond again, sorry, that was a very clear explanation. Thank you. Just to say, I mean, we're almost happy to take a steer from the board in drafting in terms of the inclusion or otherwise of E. We do think it is ultimately asking for the same thing that is in IAS 1 paragraph 38. So I don't think we would be,
And also what this Anders point was, okay, that clearly you have requests from regulators, from the SEC, from banking regulators to include stuff in your financial report. But I would never judge that it's immaterial because, if you're doing financial statements over maybe 10-year comment letter from the SEC, you have received 500 comments, please put into your financial statements this kind of information. I would always think it's material because it comes from a regulator. And then to say, okay, that is obscured by this information which was asked by the regulators, how difficult is that? I think it's impossible. So I said, okay, this 400 pages for me, all kind of information.
I cannot possibly see how this could happen in practice. I mean, how this could lead to the conclusion that this is obscure. Can we come to a vote? Mary, you want to obscure?
I wanted to say to Tom's concern and point about interaction of relevance and materiality, immateriality. Don't we have a statement somewhere that materiality is an entity-specific application of relevance, and that maybe if that, again, in the basis discussion, that may help?
I recognize that.
Yeah.
So you just be careful about drafting. Thank you.
All right. Question one. Who supports the staff's recommendation?
13.
Okay. All right.
Okay. So paragraphs 41 to 44 detail our analysis with regards to the location of the definition and material and explanatory paragraphs. In light of the feedback received, we think it is unhelpful to some stakeholders to repeat the definition of material in different standards. So question two for the board is, does the board agree with the staff recommendation that the board replaces the definition of material and explanatory paragraphs in IAS 8 with the reference to the definition of material and explanatory paragraphs in IAS 1?
I would almost say this is drafting. No? But can we agree? Yeah? Okay.
Can I ask a question?
13. Yeah. Still want to make a comment? Go ahead.
I agreed with that difficulty, but then I wanted to check that. I wanted to check what we always say is that we say we don't need to repeat that materiality applies throughout IFRSs because we have this statement somewhere that applies generally, and I was no longer able to locate that statement. So that's my first point. It would be helpful to me if I was helped to identify where it is located. And also, I was wondering if that is really true, why do we have to mention the material definition in IAS 8 at all? But I don't want to draft them. We could have a look and see if we can just reference the definition of that.
All right, move on.
Paragraphs 45 to 49 and Appendix A summarise the analysis performed in relation to the existing terminology used within the conceptual framework. Question three for the board is, does the board agree with the staff recommendation that the board should retain the proposed amendments that align terminology in the definition of material with the existing terminology in the conceptual framework?
Do we agree?
14. Paragraphs 50 to 53 detail the staff analysis and recommendation in relation to the questions raised about the inclusion of the term reasonably within the definition. Question four for the board is, does the board agree with staff recommendation that the board retains the proposed amendment to replace the threshold could influence with could reasonably be expected to influence in the definition of material?
Isn't this the question if we should do this whole thing to begin with? Okay.
Well, I already have a comment. This is a very important messaging point to me. I agree with the staff recommendation, but it's up front, and I think we probably said it in the exposure draft itself, which I regret. It sounds like this is a proactive effort to introduce new clarification, and I think what you have shown in this section here is that what you're doing is basically taking a statement about reasonable expectations that is already in the standard and incorporating it. It was there. It was authoritative. It's just incorporating it into the single standardized discussion. So I think it's not, we shouldn't question it, but we also shouldn't oversell it as a change or an effort, because I think that raises questions about whether people have to go back and reconsider other things when it was there all along.
Okay, with that clarification, yes.
14. Paragraphs 54 to 58 refer to the staff analysis for the proposed effective date. Question five is, does the board agree with the staff recommendation of an effective date of 1 January 2020 with early application permitted? 14. So finally, question six of the paper contains four parts. As these all relate to different topics, we will ask each of the four parts separately. Paragraphs 59 to 61 relate to the staff analysis performed in relation to the use of the terms immaterial and not material. Based on the analysis, we think the terms have the same meaning. Question 6A, does the board agree with the staff recommendation that no further action is taken in response to the feedback about the use of the terms immaterial and not material?
Will we have some of this in the basis for conclusion?
Yes. Yes.
Well, that's fine. Sure.
All right.
Paragraphs 62 to 64 discuss the incorporation, including by reference, of the materiality practice statement into IAS1, the conceptual framework, or both. In line with the decision made in the March 2018 board meeting, the staff recommend that the board does not incorporate any of the materiality practice statement into IAS1 or the conceptual framework at this time. Question 6B, does the board agree with the staff recommendation?
Yes.
Paragraph 65 to 67 discuss the analysis of staff performed in relation to concerns raised over the varying uses of the term material. We think that re-deliberating the use of the term material in other standards is beyond the scope of this project. And consequently, we recommend that the board take no further action in response to this feedback.
At this time.
At this time.
Do we agree? Yes, we do.
And finally, paragraphs 68 to 70 summarize the staff's analysis relating to feedback about the potential interaction with the International Auditing and Assurance Standards Board's definition of material. Does the board agree with the staff recommendation that the board should not take any further action in response to this feedback?
All right, I suggest we start again at 1 o'clock.
Yeah.